Let's share a time of silence for the time it takes for 6 or 7 deep breaths. Just let Jay's words sink in. Last November, my partner and I went on a 2-week tour of Cuba. There were about 20 of us, half from our home congregation in California, and others, new friends, from all over the United States. Just a few weeks later, while shopping at Kroger, I was struck by the contrast with what we had seen in Cuba. As I sipped an early afternoon cup of milky Starbucks coffee, it felt comfortable and cozy to be roaming the aisles, perusing the cold wall of yogurt selections, the pyramids of canned goods, the rows and rows of spices and condiments, the festival of colors in the produce section. The familiar environment and routine of grocery shopping helped numb the waves of distress I had been feeling and continue to feel since the election. When we first arrived in Camagüey, central Cuba, where our tour began, our bus was stuck behind a truck unloading bags of sugar for a provisions shop in a very narrow street. These streets were not made for giant tourist buses. This gave our guide, Janet, like Janet with a Y, an opportunity to tell us about food distribution as we watched and waited. The system in Cuba is very different from ours. Each neighborhood is supplied with basic goods according to the needs of the population. From the perspective of our commerce-based system, we would call it rationing. Healthy adults, for example, have less milk assigned to them than children and pregnant women, so they will get as much as they need. One shop provides chicken, fish, dairy, and eggs. This one has a refrigerator. Another, in this case right across the street, has sugar, beans, rice, bread, spaghetti, and cooking oil. Provechos distributors are government-run, and the people who work there receive salaries. There are also street vendors offering fruits and vegetables that they have bought at a central market where farmers bring their produce. These are not assigned by the government, and the sellers earn profits from them. Education and healthcare are high priorities in Cuba. All Cubans are entitled to the healthcare they need and to as much education as their abilities warrant. Despite the country's relatively low standard of living, these systems compare favorably with those in developed countries, such as our own. Those who attend university pay for it by spending 2 or 3 years in community service roles. Sports and the arts get government support. The cost of attending games and performances is minimal, like $1 or $2. Athletes and musicians and artists all receive salaries. In the short time we were there, we saw 3 dance companies in rehearsal, toured a music conservatory, and enjoyed live music every day at meals. Spending time among Cubans raised my awareness of the cultural conditioning we have in the United States to always want more. Consumer confidence counts as a measure of economic success in the context of the American system. Just think about that. What does that mean, consumer confidence? With a new perspective from the Cuba trip, it seems to me a euphemism for individual overindulgence. Consumer confidence. I also became aware in a new way of the growing economic inequality in our country. Of course, there is poverty in Cuba, and some people in the countryside do not even have indoor plumbing. Even in the cities, the plumbing is not so great. It's really old and fragile. But somehow, that seems less important when you consider the Cuban system entitles people, everyone, to health care, education, and shelter, and televisions and refrigerators and other things. Yanet, in response to some of our concerns about people not being able to just earn as much money as they wanted, Yanet gave us a little homily toward the end of our trip about how Cubans don't worry so much about what they don't have. They appreciate what they do have. This attitude reflects a culture of abundance rather than a culture of scarcity. They have a sense of enough that we lack, we in our empire of things, with our so-called higher standard of living. We lack a reasonable sense as a collective. We lack a reasonable sense of what is enough. I'm not an economist or a policy wonk, but as a religious leader, I view things in terms of cultural norms. As people of faith, we work together to transform culture. We aspire to shift assumptions, expectations, and institutional structures that cause suffering and promote injustice. The shift we're now working on, the shift we're working on today, is from an assumption of scarcity to one of abundance. How can we bridge this gap? How can we reset our individual sense of enough to provide a greater support for a communal sense of abundance? I know that some of us in the United States and in this room today are closer to the threshold of enough than others. Because of our lopsided economy, many have experienced it in catastrophic ways. Because of cultural norms, many of us also, many in this room, including myself, fear that we are closer to actual scarcity than we really are. Have I ever given till it hurts? That's a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer. Have I ever given till I notice even a cramp in my style? Every year, my heart calls me to contribute more and more material support, and when I say that, I usually mean money, to charity and to progressive causes, and I have yet to reach the point where giving has impacted my standard of living one iota. Not even to the point of giving up a trivial luxury like an icy beverage on a hot day. The culture of scarcity we inherit has us always wanting more. How can we ever have enough, let alone plenty, when we're surrounded and bombarded by messages urging us to acquire more things, extra things, just in case, urging us to capture bargains, even if we already have a closet full of toilet paper, for example. My grandmother used to buy toilet paper on sale until it nearly, you know, forced her out of her home. But it was on sale. I try to imagine what it must be like not to worry about health care, education, or shelter. And I try to imagine how it could free my spirit to be relieved of wanting, saving, getting, and spending. It is, if this kind of liberation is possible, I would much prefer it to the emotional numbness and fleeting pleasure of shopping. And by the way, there is an institution called Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir. Check it out on YouTube. He's been around for a while. Maybe some of you have seen him. He has a message similar to the one I'm trying to give you today. There are a number of reasons for this fear of want, the sense of scarcity that we have. One is that while many individuals enjoy affluence, as a society, we do not prioritize even basic human needs. Health, education, and general welfare have been privatized so that even those with great privilege fear they may somehow fall through the cracks. Because so many Americans are one health crisis away from losing everything, it makes sense that we would feel anxious about stocking up on all kinds of things, toilet paper and, you know, whatever. Another factor contributing to the culture of scarcity is this. The Great Depression is still part of our living memory. Those of us who were not born yet were raised by people who lived through it, or by people who were children born into it, or by their children. It was a time of widespread actual scarcity. Difficult to imagine for those of us who have not experienced it. Practices of saving, bargain shopping, acquiring, and stocking up developed at a time of real need. You couldn't discard anything because you might need it someday. These practices were handed down to generations for whom such habits have now become burdensome. What happens when nothing stops you from acquiring new things, but you can't throw or give anything away because you fear you might need it someday. You accumulate piles and piles of stuff you don't need, and by you I mean I. But I know this is a shared experience. You have a distorted sense of how much is really enough. How do we begin this cultural shift then? And what does it have to do with today's Canvas kickoff? For the fellowship's members, Canvas kickoff for the fellowship's members. Suppose we reimagine how we raise how we raise material support for the fellowship. Suppose we take a fresh look at everything we have as individuals to appreciate how much it really is. And then let's look again at what the AUUF community could have and could do. All the fellowship could be doing to fulfill the promises of the mission and to create a safe and just world within and beyond these walls. In addition to recalibrating what enough means for ourselves, what if we were to adopt the language of stewardship, as Jay explained, for our responsibility to support and sustain the fellowship? This is actually a theological term, and there are several biblical citations affirming humankind's, quote, responsible use of resources in the service of God, unquote. There is also a solid, useful, secular interpretation of steward based on Old English word roots. Stig, it's like the origin of the word sty, as in a pigsty, and weird, like ward or warden, meaning guardian. So steward thus comes to mean household guardian, caretaker, manager, person with responsibility for the welfare of the home. AUUF members, the fellowship is our spiritual home. AUUF is your spiritual home. It is your community. It is technically a charity from the perspective of taxation. I know that many of us, as Jay alluded to, have increased our donations to charities and causes we care about because they are seriously impacted by the new power dynamics in Washington. When we contribute to these charities, we are donors. And this is an empowering thing, a good thing, a hopeful thing to do. On the other hand, this community belongs to you, and you belong to it. When we pay for rent and upkeep and utilities for our individual households, we do not consider it a donation. Just like our family households, we are stewards of our own spiritual home. For the next few weeks, all members are asked to share your thoughts about your community's practices and programs to nominate fellow congregants to the search committee for your new settled minister. I know that the process of nominating members for that committee has already begun, and if you have further ideas, please share them with the person who canvasses you. And you will be asked to open your hearts to your shared responsibility as stewards of your spiritual home. Then you will find yourself in a frame of mind to offer an abundant measure of time, talent, and yes, material support for the welfare of AUUF and for the advancement of its mission. It takes time to shift cultural norms. This is the work of religious community, and the fellowship is doing it every day. You celebrate and mourn together. You speak and listen with open hearts and minds. You honor the one and the many. You revere life and affirm one another's spiritual paths. You care for each other, and you depart every week strengthened to bring your Unitarian Universalist values to the larger community. You raise thoughtful, caring young people and send them out in the world to do the same thing. Let's all undertake the journey from fear of scarcity to appreciating the abundance we enjoy and discerning a realistic sense of what is enough. And this is good for all of us, not just members of AUUF. It's good for all of us to work on this shift. Let us take note of how often we hear messages to get and spend, and how we feel about retail therapy or shopping for recreation. Let's turn instead to the company of friends, the joy of celebrating in community, to art, to music, to dance, to theater, to creative activism for the welfare of all. It is a transformation that can liberate each of us individually. It is a cultural shift that can radically transform our world. So may it be.